HBR presents.
Well, you know, the Warby Parker guys had that thing in GQ, and if we just get a thing in GQ, we're going to be the ones that make it. And the Dollar Shave Club guys, well, they had that video, and their video went viral, and that's what made the company. That is not how it works at all. It is years of hard work. It is smart people doing smart work. It is by no means ever just one thing that builds a brand. It just is impossible. It doesn't work like that. And if you find someone that has done that, I would love to meet them, because I've never met anybody that didn't agree with the sentiment that it's actually much harder.
That's Matt Scanlon. He's the co-founder and CEO of Notum. I'm your host, Patrick McGinnis, and this is FOMO Sapiens, part of the HBR Presents Network. My name is Patrick McGinnis, and I'm the guy who invented the term FOMO. That's short for fear of missing out. Today, FOMO is an epidemic, and it's changing us so much that it sort of feels like we're evolving into a new species. But FOMO doesn't have to take over your life. You can find the power to choose what you actually want and the courage to miss out on the rest. I'll show you how right here on FOMO Sapiens.
FOMO. FOMO.
Welcome to FOMO Sapiens, the show where I interview people who are changing the world and ask them how they choose from among the many opportunities and options in their busy lives. You never know what can happen when you leave the comforts of home and embark on a journey. That's the beauty of travel. It can change your life in ways you could never have imagined when you packed your passport. For my guest today, a trip to a remote region of Mongolia became the inspiration for an even bigger adventure, starting a business. Back in 2015, Matt Scanlon and his friend and now business partner, Diedrich Reismus, traveled into Mongolia's Gobi Desert with $2.5 million of cash packed in plastic bags. Their mission? To purchase 40 tons of cashmere. They realized that by partnering directly with Mongolia's herding communities, they could secure the world's finest materials at a fair price and then pass along those savings to consumers. The idea was the inspiration for a company called Notum, which responsibly sources and produces luxury knitwear while preserving the nomadic lifestyle in Mongolia. Matt is a graduate of NYU and lives in New York City. Welcome to FOMO Sapiens, Matt Scanlon. Let me start with the same question I ask of every guest. Everybody feels a little FOMO sometimes, so what turns you into a FOMO sapiens?
Probably Instagram, to be honest with you. I actually like funding news around companies in my category on Instagram. That and good press. And if my PR firm are here, they know, like, if we have a meeting, I'm already asking for the things that their other companies are getting. So yeah, I mean, just the basic stuff, I guess.
All right, so let's talk about Notum. So for the uninitiated, what is Notum?
Love that question. Well, we're an e-commerce driven clothing brand is the way I've learned to position it. But really at our core, we started the business because we had a mission, like a story I wanted to tell people about how to support communities in Mongolia, like super abstract and random. And really what it's evolved into is sharing a vision around equality. And I know how broad that then becomes, but we sell sweaters, and in return, we support these communities in Mongolia who we get the material from. But the way the analogy I use is, like, imagine you had a string and you pulled the middle of the string down, the two ends would touch, right? And so connecting the end user to the source of where it came from, and in the process celebrating the equality of that situation, the equalizingness basically of providing transparency and process to things that never had it before.
Mongolia is a major source of cashmere for the world. What percentage of cashmere does Mongolia produce?
So close to 40%.
Which is incredible, because Mongolia is a nation of roughly 3 million people.
About 3 million people,
it's yeah. One of the least densely populated in the world. It may be the least densely populated. And so you have this country that is very far from here, not easy to get to, yeah. Produces this tremendous amount of cashmere, and you are building a bridge, a virtual bridge, I guess, or a physical bridge between there and here to connect consumers to a product that, I guess, you know, we think about it 10, 20 years ago, cashmere was something that was seen as unattainable to the average person.
You look back thousands of years and it was like only for royalty, right? It was like this super rare material that represented royalty around the world. And I think over the past 20 to 30 years, it started to shift as Mongolia, one, became a capitalist country. And so the amount of animals in the country exploded. And we saw prices go down, and it started to get distributed a little bit more widely. Also, the cost of manufacturing came down, so more people could kind of access it. My opinion is less people were actually accessing what was initially very valuable about Kashmir, and in turn, destroying the environment. So there's a whole underbelly to this conversation around Kashmir that is becoming a much larger topic, that because there's so many goats now and the cost is lower than it used to be, that overpopulation of goats is destroying our environment, creating right. something called desertification, right? So goats are terrible for the environment, and their hooves will come and dig up the earth, and then they eat everything, and so it creates topsoil. In Mongolia, they have something called the windy season, where topsoil gets kind of blown away, and what's left is desert conditions, and that's called desertification. It can really be managed with just smart grasslands management, but that doesn't exist. So this is a global crisis, actually. Major climate shifts in the middle of Central Asia impact our climate in the United States. Our business is set up to undo this problem by still offering low-cost cashmere, just better quality, by removing middlemen, asking herders to have less goats, paying them more money for it, but then distributing directly to the customer.
Fascinating. So let's go back to the beginning. How did you become a man who's impassioned about Kashmir and about working with farmers in Mongolia?
Yeah, so I was originally going to go traveling around Asia, and I was going to go to Mongolia, Beijing, Shanghai, and then Southeast Asia. We had this whole trip planned, Diedrich and I. Diedrich goes by Deej.
Your co-founder.
Yeah, my co-founder. But yeah. At the time, he was a ex-college roommate of mine, and he was studying abroad, and we had this trip planned. We end up in Mongolia, first stop, and you've been there. You know it's can be overwhelming with how different it is, right? Like, it's now less so, but when we first were there, untouched in a lot of ways by what we would consider like Western civilization. And we were enticed to go on a trip out to the countryside because that's where nomadic herders live. So 3 million people in Mongolia, half of them are nomadic. They don't own homes. They don't own land. They subsist off of animal husbandry. They raise goats, but other livestock as well, and sell what comes off of those animals, meat, fiber, etc. And we wanted to go experience that, right? We'd seen pictures of it in National Geographic. It was going to be an adventure. And one thing led to another, and we were taken out into the middle of the countryside. We thought we were going on a day trip, so we thought we were basically going in a circle, and at the end of the day coming back to the city, so we didn't bring any clothing or any food. And we ended up driving this 20-hour, 22-hour trip really into the middle of nowhere. You know how remote Mongolia gets?
Yes.
This is like one of the most remote places in the world. And the guys that took us there tell us once we're there the next day that they were planning this trip for a really long time, and they were going to stay here for a month. So they graciously invited us to stay with them, which, when you think about it, like, yeah, you could be like, that's crazy. Why would they do that? But at the same time, no questions asked. Stay with us for a month. We'll take care of you, feed you, whatever. Really eye-opening
experience. Get ready for a lot of goat meat and fermented mare's milk, my friend.
Yeah. So I started to stop thinking about the things that were different about us, right? Oh, they herd goats. I used to work on Wall Street. They eat goat. I eat cheeseburgers. Like, I stopped thinking about that and started thinking about our similarities and how we were different. And it was a fairly profound understanding of, like, we're the same. There's no difference here. When these people cry, they're sad. When they laugh, they're happy. They're experiencing the human condition, relatively speaking, the same way I have my entire life, and everybody on planet Earth does. And so I just had that moment of, like, we're all the same. Like, let's stop talking about what makes us different and start thinking about what makes us the same. And wanted to find a platform with which I could share that message. How could I show people that it doesn't matter where you're from, what you do? Essentially, we're all, and at the core, a part of the same species, right? That, like, that understanding. And I love thinking about this kind of stuff, but, like, at a biological level is what has transformed our species over thousands of years, the fact that we build culture and society and groups. And so I left and decided with Diedrich to start a nonprofit. The nonprofit was going to essentially be a platform where we could continue to tell the story. Here, here's these people. Sounds very foreign. Sounds like a different part of the world. They're the same as us, actually. And here's how there's... Look at me. Look at these pictures of me with them giving me a noogie. Like, this is not different. And we need to start thinking about people as all in this, all the same. So we start the nonprofit. When we get, we overdo it, we overcomplicate it, like we did a lot of things early on. What we failed to understand at that time was that the, these herders, they herd goats, they sell the fiber of those goats, there are people who arrive and buy that material. We failed to understand that those middlemen that were buying the material were keeping prices down and selling the material for much more money. So imagine you're a herder and I'm a trader, you have goats. If the goats are healthier and produce a more valuable fiber, I'm not going to pay more for them. I want my price. I've agreed upon selling price already in the city, so I buy for the lowest price I can. You don't have access to information or technology. You don't have any leverage to negotiate against me. I go for the lowest price possible. That's not an equitable circumstance. That is not, one, how we would plan to do business, nor is that a great way of sharing a message of equality. So we stepped in to disintermediate that transaction, become traders ourselves, in the process increase your price for material but not resell it. So we would play at a lower price if we control the material than the rest of the commodity market. And that's how Nottam started. And once we started realizing we were going to build a brand, that became our platform to share this really simple message of let's connect people. That's it. We try not to overcomplicate things now. Even though we did for a really long time.
I have to imagine, I mean, as you built the company, I have to imagine that lots of people told you no. Why are you going to fail? Constantly. For example, it's a commodity. Right? I'm sure that was like, that's point number one. And then you have people who say, maybe you talk to different investors, which I know you've raised capital. So you start talking to investors. And some people will say to your story, that's amazing. I believe in your vision and I want to be there. Other people will say, I don't really care. All I care about is that you make me three times my money in 5 years or whatever that is. I'm sure you saw that all the time.
Constantly.
How do you, when you're starting a business in an industry you haven't worked in, with a very complex sort of set of interactions, you have a business with, you're dealing with nomadic farmers in Mongolia, for Pete's sake, how do you have the courage to be decisive about the things that you're doing?
I think it's a healthy blend of stupidity. I one time saw this like way of describing an entrepreneur is like you have to be like optimistic to the point that you're basically insane. That like when all the normal things say this isn't gonna work, you still have to somehow believe that it's gonna work. I can't tell you how many times I was the only person in the room that, despite all the writing on the wall and the circumstance, believed that it was gonna happen. That I could do it. So it's like this blind, not justified in any way whatsoever, confidence and optimism, a bit of stupidity, right? Like if I had actually known the consequences of the things I was doing when I was doing them, I wouldn't have done them. If you came to me, if you were me right now, you came to me and be like, you're an idiot and you're crazy and that there's no reason that should work. So it's like a lot of that, telling yourself over and over again you can do it. There were so many times in the process of building the company where I was just like, I can't do it. Like, I'm breaking down. I can't do it. And I would have that, put it in a box, move it to the side, and keep on going.
It's an interesting question because a lot of times you hear the advice for entrepreneurs that say, listen, if you want to be an entrepreneur in XYZ industry, go work in that industry, build up a base of experience, and then you can come and attack it and your chance of success will be high. Now, there is a countercurrent, which I've heard, sometimes in order to truly disrupt an industry, you need a pure outsider. And I would say that that definitely does happen, but the chances of succeeding in that scenario with the pure outsider are much lower. Mm-hmm. Although if you can do it, you know, you're coming at it from a completely different side, so you potentially the value creation is much higher. I don't know. What do you think about that? How do you see that trade-off?
I agree. I agree with the thought process. I think there's a lot we looked at very differently. And then there were things that we just needed to do the way they were supposed to be done, mm-hmm. right? Like merchandising for product pretty much needs to happen the way merchandising's always happened. Inventory planning needs to happen the way inventory plans have been bought. Like the things that are traditional to our category of buying product and selling product, you just need to know how to do.
Yes.
My feeling was I'm actually only good at a couple of things, like one or two things. I just need to convince people that are smarter than me and better than me to do everything else. So I need to manufacture the tools to be able to do that, right? To convince people. I need to raise the money to go pay people who I then convinced to do that. It was a process, and I kind of had to take it step by step. As I invested a little bit on my own now, and I normally find value in entrepreneurs who have this set of experiences that I never had. Like the learning curve was really, really steep for a very long time for me. But you know, there's something to be said in terms of the value of a company being driven by somebody who will stop at nothing to make it work, even if the odds suggest it shouldn't and their education and their background also suggest that it's impossible. That is a really, really valuable asset. Then when mixed with the right amount of capital and the right people, can be extremely an extremely valuable venture. And I think, you know, a lot of ways that's kind of what Nottam was. I just, you know, I look back over the years, I'm like, I made so many stupid mistakes because not only did I not know, but I wouldn't listen to anybody even if they told me early on. So like, I was the right mix of like stupid and probably arrogant that it just, I don't know, fostered probably doing it the hard way. I did it the hard way for sure.
Well, you had early on, so I remember this. And what year did you make this video?
We made our first like brand video in 2017.
Okay, 2017. I go on Facebook and somebody had sent me a video about Mongolia. And I've been to Mongolia a couple times. I love Mongolia. I saw this video about these two guys who are from New York that had worked in finance that go to Mongolia and brings $2.5 million, I believe, of cash with them or something crazy like that. And I remember thinking to myself, this was the coolest thing, probably sort of origin story of a company I'd ever seen. Then I thought to myself, like, why didn't I do this? And I felt all the FOMO. And then I thought to myself, what a brilliant idea it was. And then I looked at how many views you got, and you were in the millions. And I thought to myself, like, these guys have captured something extraordinary, whatever, they've done something really magical to create a beautiful, and by the way, you can go find this video online, and we'll tell you at the end where to find it, because it's really worth a watch. It's beautifully done. And I just remember being so impressed, and it just seemed to me so fresh and such a new way of promoting a brand. But at the same time, I know that these things don't, there is no such thing as viral videos just happening. I mean, unless you have a cat that is really extraordinarily unusual. These things happen because of planning. And so I'd love to hear, number one, why you decided to go about introducing the brand in that way, because few brands have succeeded doing that. And then how did you manage to create the virality around the video to tell the story of your brand?
So I always felt that my story, the story of Nottam, was really unique, right? And that it was a personal story. And so I always saw the way that people wanted to retell it, wanted to evangelize it, wanted to like be part of the story. Mm-hmm. And my problem was that I couldn't sit in front of every single person and tell them the story. It just doesn't make sense. And for a long time, I didn't feel comfortable putting it in any sort of video format because I didn't really know what it was yet. Like it was my experience, it was my story, but I just didn't understand it. And, you know, obviously you see the viral videos that blow up a company, and yeah, maybe there's millions of views on this video, but I haven't seen a direct correlation between the video and it blowing up our company.
That's amazing.
The company has grown because we've hired amazing people that know how to do what they do really, really well.
Yeah.
The video is the icing on the cake. The video is like, oh yeah, and by the way, here it is in a really digestible, easy format. But if I didn't have the right digital marketers putting it in front of you at the right time, if I didn't have the right content producers creating consistency around our brand always, if we didn't have the right operations people getting the product there in time and the customers, like all those pieces, if they don't work perfectly, it does not matter if your video is the coolest thing in the world. It's all about the people. The best investments I've made over and over and over again, and I would do this every single time, is invest in people. I wish I had done that sooner. I look back, I just wish there was so much I could have listened to, but people are the best investments. The video for me was a special moment when we launched it because I was very close in terms of writing the script and overseeing the production of it. We did hire great people to do the editing is like everything in video production, by the way. Like, camera's a camera. Get someone that knows how to work it. You need a really good editor who knows how to put those pieces together to tell a story really well. The good news is our story was our story. It wasn't like contrived. I didn't need someone to like write it for me. At the end of the day, it would flow out of us very naturally, and it did at that time. I love thinking about kind of the psychological, biological piece of how human beings attach themselves to brands and brand values. And I think probably that video touches on some sort of science there, if I had to guess, right? Like, maybe, I don't think it's FOMO necessarily, but I think it's kind of like this endearing factor of like wanting to be part of something that somebody else is working really hard for. But I don't know. I definitely always point to that and think it's, one of the best things I've ever done.
When I saw that video, I thought to myself, like, this is going to drive a crazy amount of sales. Their website's going to crash. They're going to be national figures. I mean, I remember I was just, I watched it like three times. But what you just said something a minute ago that I think is really interesting, which is that a lot of times people think, oh, I just get that one social media mention from that celebrity. I just get that one viral video. I get, whatever it is, that TV appearance. And I remember I've seen this with all my friends and things that I've worked on. It's never just one thing. There can be maybe, there are stories. We could come up with a story about somebody who goes viral out of the blue. But the reality is behind the scenes, they had a plan. And in fact, nothing is as easy as it looks. And so the fact that that was your experience it's good to know that gravity applies to all of us.
It's the truth. I used to think the same thing.
Yeah.
I was like, well, the Warby Parker guys had that thing in GQ. And if we just get a thing in GQ, we're going to be the ones that make it. And the Dollar Shave Club guys, they had that video and their video went viral. And that's what made the company. That is not how it works at all. It is years of hard work. It is smart people doing smart work. It is by no means ever just one thing that builds a brand. It just is impossible. It doesn't work like that. And if you find someone that has done that, I would love to meet them because I've never met anybody that didn't agree with the sentiment that it's actually much harder. And when you hear about the story of a company that owned 2 years, hundreds of millions, no friggin' way. The people that are behind that company, we're doing it for years before that. Like, the world doesn't work like that. We like to sensationalize. We like to romanticize this entrepreneur, like fast growth thing. Nothing can replace, I think, hard work, little luck, a lot of good timing, right? Like, if Nottam had started 10 years ago, no one cares, right? Sustainability, whatever. Just like, give us a good product, or what, right? Like, so I'm pretty pragmatic in that regard, and I think if we just keep our head down and keep on looking straight ahead when we need to, stay focused, we'll be okay. Let's not get distracted by all this other stuff, because this is the first thing we spoke about. You were like, what do you get FOMO from? It's like, what distracts you, basically? What are the things that distract you? That's it, right? Like, when I'm worried about, like, oh, what's this company doing? Because I read that article and that thing. Like, come on. I've been in those articles before, and I know that it's different than that. So I'll work with other entrepreneurs now, and they're like, well, I'm really down. This company's launching. It's in my category, and it's doing this thing. And I'm like, do you really know? Have you spoken to their founders? Have you spoken to people who work at the company? Do you know anything for real? Because if not, shut up and just go back to work, because this doesn't matter, I promise you. And, more often than not, I have to remind myself of that, but That's what I think the reality of all of this is.
It's so true.
Sound like such a cynic.
No. I think what you're saying, if I can sort of tell you what I'm hearing, is that there are a lot of messages that are coming at us all the time. And it could be, for example, and you see this a lot with entrepreneurs, they don't want to tell you their business plan because they're afraid somebody's going to steal it. And I always say to them, listen, building any business that's worth building takes 5-10 years. And so the notion that somebody's going to spend the next 10 years of their life pursuing your dream makes no sense at all.
It's something that I've continuously had to remind myself of. Probably a couple of years ago, I had an advisor, and I was kind of getting distracted. I tend to get distracted by things. And I was talking about a competitor that was launching, and I was kind of in this situation. And he said, just focus. And he pulled up a photo, and it was a picture of, I don't know if you've ever seen this photo, but it was Michael Phelps. And it's at the end of a race. And you see him out front, and he's heads down, finishing. And then you see somebody next to him looking at him finishing.
Yes. That's incredible.
If you're busy looking left and right at what everybody's doing, you're not focused on what's right ahead of you. The people that are looking straight ahead and focused on getting the job done and working hard and doing what they know that they're confident about are the ones that win.
So I think you just answered the next question, which is, this is the show about finding the power to choose. You actually wanted the courage to miss out on the rest. So it sounds like what you're saying is just focus.
Focus has produced the best results for our business over and over and over again. It's hard sometimes, right? Like, things are enticing, and people make them look more enticing than they actually are most of the time. That's how marketing works. That's literally what marketing and sales is. So if you're susceptible to it, great. You're like a normal human being. However, I'm confident that it's the people that can focus and are maniacal in that focus about what they know and what they want are the ones that are successful. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to come in contact with great people who've given me pieces of good advice. And I've noticed the people that the most successful people I've been around, people that are like billionaire heavy hitters, whatever. And listen, this might not be a good thing, but you get in a conversation with them and they have their whole conversation planned out before you're a part of it, right? Like, they know exactly what they're saying and everything. You're just part of their conversation that they're having with themselves. That's like crazy. That's probably like on the like a spectrum of like way too focused, but like that's what it takes sometimes. Yeah. Like, I'm not listening to you in this conversation. I know what my vision is. I know what I want, and I'm saying it exactly how I want. It does not matter what your contribution is. I know it, and I'm going to get it no matter what.
And they practice, because people who are successful, for example, entrepreneurs or CEOs, they're kind of like politicians in a way. They tell the same story over and over again. They have their story down, and they know how to present themselves in public. So your point is a really interesting one. I never really thought about it that way, but I have to agree.
If you ever listen to another podcast I've done, I literally just said the same stuff over and over again.
Oh, no. Okay, everybody. I don't know if we're going to air this show after all. We'll just edit together some of your other appearances. Okay, and I have one more question for you. You can't have it all as much as anybody tries. So as you build Nahdam, what are you missing out on?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question.
I bet they never asked that on the other shows.
Never. I'll be honest with you. I've been doing this for a long time, and you really have to sacrifice a lot of the things outside of work to be successful, I think. And I know other people will say, oh, no, work-life balance. But like for me, I had to sacrifice all of that, right? Like, I see my friends every 6 months or so. Like, I work all the time. I don't go on a lot of vacations. I don't sleep a lot. I work. That's the sacrifice I made. Was I knew that for me personally, I'm not the smartest person in the room most of the time. I have to work harder than other people to kind of get what I want, and I have to consistently reinforce my focus and what I want all the time if I'm going to get it. So that means, yeah, I don't get to have like a super robust outside life right now. But my feeling is eventually it'll pay off.
Matt, thanks a lot for stopping by. If people want to find out more about Nahdam and about you, where can they do that?
You can find us at Nahdam.co. That's Nahdam, as in Matt, .co. And the video's up there and everything.
check out the video. I guess I plugged the video enough.
Pretty
but,
hard.
But also, go to Mongolia. If you're inspired by this and what you see. Naadam is a festival that's done in the summertime in Mongolia. Mm-hmm. I think both of us have been to it. It's a fantastic time to go visit the country. It's a little bit of a long flight, but the other thing is you can pick up some deals on cashmere while you're there. And if you don't go, you can always go to Naadam.co and buy something here.
I agree. I concur.
All right, Matt. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
FOMO.
And now it's time for the FOMO moment of the show, which is when I talk about FOMO and its role in pop culture, or tell you about something that's giving me FOMO. Financial titan Charles Schwab just released its 2019 Modern Wealth Index Survey, an annual examination of how 1,000 Americans think about saving, spending, investing, and wealth. And guess what they found? FOMO is driving your financial decisions. To find out more, I'm joined by Terry Carlson, Executive Vice President and Head of Schwab Investor Services. So break it down for us. How is FOMO affecting our spending habits?
Well, you know, it has a lot to do with trying to keep up with the Joneses. That has been a part of our American culture for decades, but it really feels like social media and the fear of missing out have increased the pressure to spend. In Schwab's most recent Modern Wealth survey, about a third of Americans admit that their spending habits have been influenced by what their friends are posting on social media. And of that, 35% are confessing that they're spending more than they can afford to avoid missing out on the fun things that they seem to think their friends are doing. And 60% say they're at a loss to understand how their friends afford such expensive vacations and trendy restaurants that they show on social media.
Yeah, I think I've fallen victim to that. And a fun fact for you, Terry, is that Keeping Up the Joneses actually was a comic strip that started in the early 1900s about a guy named Aloysius McGinnis. So I'm actually related to that in some way or another, at least by my last name.
Well, is that how you came up with the information to invent FOMO?
No, but it just tells me the universe is working in a magical way. So based on what you said, it's interesting. I'm curious if you found any correlation between age of the people that you surveyed, whether millennials or Gen Z were suffering more from this type of spending habit.
Yeah, absolutely. We have found that 70% of Generation Z and millennials are feeling more pressure based on FOMO or the social media. And so it's something, you know, as they're thinking about their careers and their spending habits, something they need to be much more aware of to avoid overspending.
Well, the good thing is you're here today to tell us what to do about it. Obviously, Schwab manages money for lots of people. You know your clients well. And I would love to know, do you have any advice for our listeners with regards to how to avoid this temptation?
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, the first thing to keep in mind is that spending, it's not the enemy. But when we allow the social pressure or other forces to lure us into spending beyond our means, it can really start to impact long-term financial stability and really takes away from, I think, individuals' peace of mind. And the most important thing I'd want our listeners to know that it's about balancing spending and saving so that we can enjoy life today but still achieve long-term security. And I, for one, as a certified financial planner, believe that everyone should try to have a written financial plan because it can be extremely helpful in understanding the balance that's needed between spending and saving overall.
Very sage advice. Terry Carlson, thanks for being here today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
FOMO.
If you have an idea for the FOMO moment of the show, or if you have a question or comment, reach out to me at letsconnect@patrickmcginnis.com or send me a tweet at PJMcGinnis. Also, you can take the official FOMO Sapiens diagnostic at patrickmcginnis.com/FOMO-quiz and find out if you're a FOMO Sapiens. FOMO Sapiens is part of the HBR Presents FOMO Network. The show is produced by AW360 and recorded FOMO in New York City. Theme music is by Mike McGinnis. FOMO. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. FOMO. And as always, you can find me at patrickmcginnis.com. FOMO. You can also take the official FOMO diagnostic at patrickmcginnis.com/FOMO-quiz to find out if you're a FOMO Sapiens.
FOMO.
FOMO.